Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Jonathan Alpern, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Minnesota, about the economics of essential medicines.
Yeah, and I think, like, when I get stranded in the desert, I want to know what those essential medicines are. What are the three I really need to have? It's one of those games you play. But we're going to ask him, what are the essential medicines and what are the economics? I'm looking forward to it.
That's right, me too. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about how often the best medicines are prescribed to people who have atrial fibrillation to prevent strokes.
We're going to talk about health policy and do the state laws that try to make it more stringent on opioid pain medicine prescribing, are they working?
And we're going to talk about the money that people in America spend out of pocket on complementary health approaches.
And then we're just going to dive into some art. And you'll have stay tuned. Figure
it out.
Let's
art
talk about our
medicine.
Very first research that matters about atrial fibrillation and aspirin. And I think we've really kind of talked about in the past, Christy, that there are a lot of people who are maybe should be on a blood thinner other than aspirin but aren't getting it. And some people, I think this research shows, are getting two drugs rather than one drug. What's going on?
Yeah, so this was research published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology recently, looking at more than 200,000 patients with atrial fibrillation who are at risk for stroke, really finding that we know that approximately 40% of patients who are at risk for stroke were treated with aspirin alone, even though we know that aspirin alone is not as beneficial as the oral blood thinners like warfarin and some of the newer medications.
Yeah, and it doesn't really tell us why. You know, why are a third of the patients just getting aspirin who, by the guidelines, looks like they should be on a stronger blood-thinning type of drug that would be more effective and cut their stroke down? Is it because they've had the conversation and the patients don't want it because the doctor doesn't know the guidelines and isn't recommending it? And then the patients who are getting two drugs, but it looks like they should only be one, are those two drugs being given for two different reasons, but then the risk of bleeding is so high? To me, this raises more questions than answers, but it does encourage me to say, if you're a patient out there, talk with your doctor about why you're on these drugs and is there a better drug or less drugs that you could be on.
Absolutely. I mean, really well said. I think this is, if you have or your loved one has atrial fibrillation, this needs to be a conversation that you have with your doctor. Am I on the right blood thinner and why? And let's talk about that. Okay, let's go to our next research that matters. And this is more research related to opioid prescribing. These are those pain medications, narcotic or opioid medications that we know, we've been talking about on the show, are leading to a big epidemic in overdose and death related to taking these medications. So the question here that was looked at from the Dartmouth Institute of Health Policy and also at the UCLA School of Law was looking at state laws over the last decade or more that have been aimed at curbing prescription opioid abuse. Do they actually make a difference?
And they looked at 81 laws between 2006 and 2012. And these were laws such as you can't go from one doctor to another. Doctors need to use tamper-resistant prescription forms. And then a really big one, which was the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, an online database that allows law enforcement and doctors to monitor prescriptions. And I know I've used this sort of database probably at this time as when I started using it too.
Oh, right. I mean, these have been very, very helpful from a physician perspective. But this is looking at the effect of these laws and looking at the most risky category of Medicare beneficiaries, so people who have both a disability and are on Medicare between ages of 21 and 64.
And these people have higher rates of opioid use. They have lower health status. They're poorer. So this is much more difficult population than the general population.
Right. And they found that there were really no significant associations between the state laws and dangerous prescribing patterns like very high daily opioid doses or the rates of non-fatal overdose. So overdoses that maybe didn't take someone's life. But they looked at that and found no difference in the state laws. Now, they haven't looked yet, haven't had time, at some of the newer laws that are being put into place that are more stringent, making sure doctors consult that database before they do prescriptions. Some things that have some controversy over challenges for doctors to make prescriptions, but may have a bigger impact as they are becoming more stringent.
I don't think there would be many people out there, Christy, despite anyone's political persuasion, that would say lessening the laws on prescribing of opioids is a good thing. Now, it'll be time and perhaps some more research to figure out how to make these laws stronger and more effective. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It just means we need more research because we shouldn't do the things necessarily that are ineffective. We should focus on things that are effective.
Agree. Now let's talk about the money that people spend on out-of-pocket complementary health approaches. So what we're talking about by this are the medications and supplements and alternative therapies that people pursue, like herbal supplements, meditation, chiropractors, yoga, acupuncturists. There are all kinds of different sort of out of standard medical care expenses that people are putting forward with their pocket change.
Yeah, this was a research that was looked at by the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they basically found that Americans are spending almost $15 billion pretty much out of pocket. A lot of this is not reimbursed on different sorts of practitioners, another several billion dollars on these products, and then another couple billion dollars on self-care. And I looked at this, and my first thought is, wow, there's a lot of out-of-pocket spending. But then I also thought, well, you know, some of these things, I mean, many of these things I actually do myself, and I'm thinking, I really wish they were actually in the healthcare system being reimbursed because I think that they're, you know, very beneficial. As beneficial as some other things that we're already paying for. Like, I really don't understand why massage therapy, a yoga prescription, meditation prescription, those things that don't hurt people can really help them, why we're not actually reimbursing for it. I find that a little crazy myself.
Well, and when we're talking about $30.2 billion out-of-pocket dollars on these complementary health approaches, you know, as we're talking about the cost of medicine and our healthcare system and all the ways that impact society, we need to be including these costs in that total approach that we're taking as a nation. And many of these are more cost-effective than some of the things that we're doing within the medical system. But I'd also argue that there are some of these supplements that people that are not necessarily evidence-based medications that people are turning to and spending their money on because either a lack of trust or because they're looking for some alternative options. And so it's complicated.
You got 10 different supplements, your B-complex vitamins, your vitamin E, C.
Right. Some of that's just wasted money that your body's not even absorbing.
But I want my gummy bear fiber to be paid for. Can that get paid for?
I don't know. I mean, it's getting paid for now.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, Christy, which is our last one, which is about art therapy. And I think we both, we were talking about this right before the show, and we were both kind of sharing with each other that both of our mothers have been doing art therapy recently. And how exciting is that?
I know. Well, my mom, who's in her 70s, recently began painting, and it's a new hobby. And I'm just so excited for her as she owns a business, a very successful and stressful business, and is transitioning sort of into retirement, but that's hard to do with a small business. And this gives her something else to focus on.
Yeah, well, my mom, she started painting a couple months ago, really, and now two or three times a week is doing 3 hours at a time. And the research here is, does this lower people's stress level? Does it lower the cortisol level? And this was research that was published in Art Therapy, looking at almost 40 adults from 18 to 59 and 45 minutes of art making, and then looking at cortisol levels, which is that stress hormone, before and after the art making.
And they found that there is a reduction of cortisol levels in participants who are doing art making projects. And it's exciting to me, you know, and just thinking about the application to our mothers, that there's this activity that's very positive and creative, and using, whether you're great at it or not, that there's something really positive about making art and about doing something creative. And at least with my mom, it's been like something she's good at. It's a new skill, a new thing to be proud of. And so there are those elements too that I feel like also contribute in the reduction of stress and overall well-being.
Well, we might put with a little bit of encouragement from our listeners or even our mothers, two of the pictures from Christy's mom, maybe my mom, we'll put them up on our website. They're not for sale. I must say that for my mother, probably not yours either.
I doubt my mom
and they
would be
a little embarrassed,
share.
But you know what? I think we could encourage others to emulate. It's a great thing. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to be speaking with our great guest.
And we'll be talking with Dr. Jonathan Alpern, a fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Minnesota, about the economics of essential medicines. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Jonathan Alpern, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Minnesota, about the economics of essential medicines.
Welcome, Dr. Alpern. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Now, you are doing your fellowship working in infectious diseases. Tell us how you became involved and passionate about that field of study.
Yeah, so, you know, I really like the breadth of knowledge required in the field of infectious disease. You know, you have to know not only the patient in front of you, but as well as, you know, all the pathogens that can cause human disease. So I sort of enjoyed the, you know, how much you needed to know. There's a social aspect to the field that I was drawn to as well. You know, knowing what kind of environment your patient lives in, their socioeconomic status, where they've traveled, for instance, all of those become very relevant, and I was interested in those things.
And I understand you came from clinic earlier today. Tell us a little bit about what did you see in clinic today?
Sure. So today, you know, is actually we saw patients on the inpatient side, so in the hospital. So a typical day would be seeing you know, anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15, however many patients are on your service. Seeing them in the hospital, we round in the morning with our staff as well as other residents and medical students who are on the service. We come up with their treatment plan for the day.
And what kind of problems do they have?
Yeah, so it ranges. So here at Hennepin County Medical Center, we see just about everything. HIV, AIDS, and the complications of that disease. So opportunistic infections that result from not having a normal immune system, to skin and soft tissue infection, bone infections. It's quite variable. It's what makes it interesting.
Wow. Well, we're glad that you're doing that work. We're talking today about an article that you recently wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine. Congratulations. About restricted access to essential medication. And before we get into that, would you mind sharing with our listeners how organizations like the World Health Organization and others, what is the definition of an essential medication?
Now, the WHO defines essential medicines as drugs that satisfy the priority health needs of the population. So they consider a few factors: the disease prevalence, the public health significance of a disease, clinical efficacy and safety, as well as cost effectiveness. You know, an important point, though, is that these are drugs intended to be affordable. So we found that in the U.S., this wasn't always the case. So many of the drugs on that WHO list were actually not affordable in the U.S. And this is paradoxical because many of them can be bought cheaply abroad in other countries.
So give us an example of an essential medicine. So just so our listeners who may not have, I mean, that's a lot of complicated ideas of some essential medicines in the U.S.
And one of the ones that I think of, and you can tell me if this is the case, is treatment of tuberculosis, where I would say it's essential that we treat it. We know the drugs that treat it. And, you know, we always have to think, God, I don't know how much they cost, though.
That's exactly right. So some of the drugs we use to treat TB, this is a drug we commented on earlier, is a drug called albendazole, which is a anti-parasitic drug used to treat parasitic infections. And this is a drug with minimal to no therapeutic alternative. So this is a drug required if you get certain parasitic infections. So it's essential. It made the list because it sort of satisfied those criteria that I had mentioned.
And a disease that is very rare, even there are only maybe one or two drugs, if it's exceedingly rare, it would not be essential?
Right. So, you know, the WHO has decided based on the significance of the disease to the public. So that's exactly right. So certainly if a disease was not prevalent enough, it might not make it onto the list. I will say, you know, there are certainly drugs on the list that treat diseases that are much rarer in the United States, for instance, than they would be in other countries.
Like,
you know, albendazole is a good example where it treats infections that might be more common in a developing country but is more rare in the United States, and it treats diseases that we see predominantly in immigrant and refugee patients, but one where if they were to get an infection requiring that medication, it would be necessary. They would need it.
Well, and in some instances, when I've been overseas, the cost of getting those medications here is quite high, but you can get them in Africa for much cheaper. And so getting some and bringing them back over here to then help our refugee population has sometimes been a helpful strategy.
That's exactly right.
Now, you talk in your article, you open with the story about Turing Pharmaceuticals and some treatment and raising the price of one of their drugs related to toxoplasmosis. Help us and our listeners by sharing some of the specifics of that story. What is toxoplasmosis? What were the implications around raising the price of the medication?
So this was a story that grabbed everyone's attention, and it certainly grabbed the attention of infectious disease doctors. I'll start with sort of what happened. So in August of last year, Turing Pharmaceuticals, which is a small private biopharmaceutical startup, acquired the rights to Daraprim, or the generic name is called pyrimethamine, and raised the price by over 5,000%. So they acquired the drug and raised the price by 5,000%. Now, this was disturbing because Daraprim is the standard of care for treating toxoplasmosis, which is a serious parasitic infection that we see in patients with HIV/AIDS, as well as immunosuppressed patients who have received transplantation. So the implications of this was that as a result of the price increase, patients diagnosed with toxoplasmosis are having serious access problems. So either substantial delays in their treatment or receiving second-line therapy. So we took a particular interest in the story because we had previously written about a very similar price hike that had occurred for albendazole. And the more we researched, we were finding that these were not unique examples, but this was happening to many other drugs as well.
So, you know, this is not just a bad apple, one bad company that's doing something that people have problems with, right? That's what I found kind of remarkable. You find this is somewhat more a systematic issue. Is that correct?
That's right. You know, we found that this was happening to many other drugs that fit the similar sort of profile as Daraprim. So these what we describe is a business model that's very concerning. So these are companies that are targeting what we call niche drugs, at times sort of treating small populations of patients where there's limited alternative options, and they find themselves the only sort of the one manufacturer of the drugs. There's little competition, and then they raise the price. And in the United States, it's legal. And so we found multiple examples where this would happen, where patients run into problems, and where providers are put in very difficult positions.
And I guess at one level, maybe our listeners might be saying, well, this is capitalism. We're a society, and this is a business decision. But I was struck by the fact that one of the companies was bought and then sold to an investor group. And so it was so clearly that these aren't companies like our traditional pharmaceutical companies that are spending a tremendous amount of money on research and development. You say these companies that are doing this, and some have been high profile like Valiant and some others, are doing this really specifically to maximize profit. Is that and what's the downside for that?
Yeah, that's right. So you bring up a good point. So what I would say would be, you know, it's one thing for a company who's put in the research and development into a drug to charge high prices. So we see that with, for instance, some of the new hepatitis C drugs. You know, a new brand name drug comes onto market and the company can charge high prices. To some extent, that's justified because they've put in the time, they've put in the resources. But it's another thing altogether when you have companies who are acquiring the rights to essential medicines that have limited therapeutic options, develop a monopoly, and then raise the price at will. You know, such a model doesn't put anything back into the healthcare system.
It certainly raises some real ethical concerns there and dilemmas. This is a fascinating conversation, and there's more to the ethics of this. We do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Jonathan Alpern, fellow in the Division of Infectious Disease at the University of Minnesota, about the economics of essential medicines. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. You're listening with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Alpern, fellow in the Division of Infectious Disease at the University of Minnesota, about the economics of essential medicines. And before the break, Dr. Alpern, you were outlining for us some of the ethical dilemmas and challenges related to drug companies developing a monopoly on medications and being able to hike up the price in a way that limits people's ability to receive essential medications. We found it shocking that these types of price hikes are legal. And in your article, you mentioned that market solutions might be a way to regulate this. Give us a sense of what kind of solutions you have in mind, considering that these are complicated businesses that are also taking care of people.
So that's right. So, you know, when a company's developed a monopoly, it can legally raise the price at will and really to whatever extent it wishes. So, you know, when high prices result from monopolies, we think there needs to be market solutions that promote competition. So right now, there's very little incentive for a company to bring a generic drug to market, given how expensive and lengthy the process is to gain FDA approval. So I think, you know, we talked about one solution could come from the FDA. So recently, the FDA actually put forth a proposal to expedite the review of new drug applications for generic entrants. So these are companies that would bring in competition to a market that has very little few companies in it. And so their proposal was to expedite the review for new drug applications when only one manufacturer exists. So the problem that we're talking about.
So making it faster to develop competition.
That's right. We think this may encourage potential entrants that would otherwise sort of have little incentive to enter the market. The other option there would be to eliminate user fees, so sort of more incentive for companies to enter the market.
Well, I'm certain that the market competition certainly makes some sense. It's consistent with the culture of how we would like to perhaps and see the, you know, competition work. Is there legal remedies? Are there shame remedies? Are there other things that can be done in the short term? Because I suspect you still have patients that you're seeing every day in your hospital and your clinics that this is a problem, right?
No, that's right. So, you know, there are many potential solutions that have been brought forth. But this is a really difficult position we're in with, I think, very few options. But I'll lay out a few. One option that has been brought up has been compounding pharmacies. So these are pharmacies that have been able to provide cheaper versions of many of the drugs that we've described. You know, we think this is helpful to individual patients in some circumstances, but probably not a sustained long-term solution because compounding pharmacies don't provide access to all of the essential medicines. In addition, insurance plans don't always cover compounded drugs, so this might negate any potential cost savings.
And they don't have the same, do they have the same regulation too, or no?
Correct. They do not have the same regulation. So the other point I would make would be patient assistance programs are offered by some pharmaceutical companies. So some companies will provide assistance to patients unable to afford a medicine. These aren't always available or reliable, but that is an option. And then finally, we've anecdotally found in some of our patients that they'll try to buy expensive medicines from overseas through family members abroad at much cheaper prices. You know, as a provider, it's hard to sort of recommend against such a practice when the alternative is that your patient will go without therapy. However, again, in terms of a sort of a sustainable model, this is not something that I think we can rely on as a healthcare system, and it really puts providers in a difficult position.
Now, I know you've done some work more broadly around the price of medications and thinking about these larger issues. How do other developed nations handle this, and how do they view us for some of the challenges that we have in our nation related to prices of medications?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So there's a large discrepancy between the pricing that we're seeing in the United States and the pricing in other countries. For instance, you know, when you compare the United States to Canada or countries in Europe, there are regulatory mechanisms in place that prevent companies from doing the sorts of things that they're doing here, so raising the price at will. Governments in other countries have the ability to intervene and prevent from such sustained price hikes. So some of the solutions that have been recommended involve having the government intervene here.
And what the argument would be, well, we get the best drugs because we have the market forces to drive the creation of new drugs and the opportunity to make profit from that. Are other countries having access to the same quality of medications that we have here in the United States?
You know, I can comment on the drugs that we talk about, which are essential medicines,
mm-hmm.
medicines that community, the healthcare systems have decided are crucial for their community, for individual patients. And other countries are able to provide those drugs at affordable prices in many cases.
And I know you, in your New England Journal of Medicine article, Dr. Alpern, you talk about really the effects on individual patients, those who are perhaps most vulnerable. Give us an example, if you could, and how this really affected you.
One good example would be a patient that I cared for in fellowship who was diagnosed with a new diagnosis of AIDS, of HIV-AIDS, and this patient had also a new diagnosis of toxoplasmosis. Because of the price hike, this was not a medicine that was currently being stocked by our hospital, and so the patient, unfortunately, was not able to receive first-line therapy. We gave her second-line therapy. To me, I think that struck me because this is something that can be bought for cheaply in other countries, and yet here's an example where we have so much at our fingertips, and yet we couldn't get this patient the standard of care treatment.
And the cost would have been how much?
It would have been upwards of, I believe it was $70,000 to acquire the medication. For the hospital to acquire the medication.
Wow. This is where I think there could be some shaming.
Well, and I don't think people realize, and it's wonderful that you're raising light to this issue, that here in America there are patients who cannot get these essential medications related to our broken healthcare system. And so thank you for raising this issue in the literature and bringing it to our listeners today. If you could leave one final thought for our listeners in a way that they could advocate or just something to pay attention to, what would be that final thought?
I would say it's one thing for a company to, who's put in the research and development into a drug to charge high prices, but it's another thing when we have companies acquiring the rights to a drug that they've not developed and then raise the price at will to a level that is not affordable for patients. And I think we need to pay attention to this. It's a business model that we've tried to draw attention to. And I thank you for having me on. This has been great. And I thank you for drawing attention to the issue as well.
Well, we really appreciate your work. You may be a fellow and young in your career, but you're certainly really wise and sharing that wisdom with our listeners. We appreciate that. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Alpern, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Minnesota, about his New England Journal of Medicine article, The Economics of Essential Medicines.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns. Thanks for writing us.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question about healthy barbecue. Go for it, Daniel.
Now that it's nice out, I've been at a barbecue pretty much every weekend, but I feel like a weekly dose of burgers and brats can't be good for me. Do you have any recommendations for more healthful barbecue fare?
Well, you're talking to the right guy here, Sonny. Let me tell you, being a vegetarian, I feel like at a disadvantage every time I go to barbecues over other people's houses. But come on over to my house, and I'm going to tell you what you're going to get. You're going to get some barbecue tofu or some barbecue tempeh or, I know that doesn't sound so good, those vegan burgers or
black bean
burgers.
We're going to be lining up outside your house.
Boca
burgers.
None of that sounds great. So far, so good? How are we doing?
No.
How about barbecue fish, salmon?
Yeah. Or grilled chicken. Yeah.
Grilled chicken. Okay, yep. That would work.
And sometimes it requires you to participate by bringing some healthy options to throw on the grill, right? So some vegetable skewers or some options, or bring some fruit to the party.
Roasted red peppers and asparagus. Ooh, sometimes I even do some corn on the grill.
Oh, corn on the grill
is
the
best. Oh, my
goodness.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, except
for
then you put it butter and salt all over it, and it becomes something else.
Well, he didn't say it was about health. Oh, I guess he is.
Yes, he did. But congratulations for paying attention to your health and really being mindful of what you're putting into your body. But you can have a good time at a barbecue, have delicious food, and also be a person who brings some healthy vegetables, chicken, or other options.
Maybe we could get some recipes. Maybe we have someone who loves to cook, and you could send us some recipes as listeners. My daughter might have some healthy recipes. We could share those on our website. We'll do that.
Fantastic. Okay, Daniel, let's hear our next House Call question.
I've been feeling really tired for a year. I'm depressed, but I don't think that's the whole picture. A friend said I likely have inflammation and allergies, so should I have an allergy workup?
Oh, Christy, this one's yours.
Yeah, this one's complicated.
This is complicated.
It is, because it is common that depression and fatigue can be very much overlapped. And so it is often really difficult to tease out how much of one's tiredness is depression, which is the most common thing, or how much of it is also impacted by sleep and other things that are all interwoven into depression-related symptoms. And then there are other things that can make you tired, like having a virus or an illness. Allergies and inflammation aren't normally like, oh, that's the cause of fatigue. But it is complicated. So this is one of those things where having a continuity doctor, having someone that you're going back to regularly to tease through it, can be really helpful.
Yeah, you have a sense that there's something else going on here. And I respect that fully. And I think it's reasonable to sometimes do a limited workup and look for a few other things, perhaps, to make sure you haven't had some tick exposure. I would not go do a comprehensive allergy workup. You're starting to get into there a different way of maybe understanding what the cause is. And that, I'm not saying that's a wrong as a cause, but it's a different way than perhaps most physicians who are trained, perhaps like Christy and I. And particularly if it's going to be really expensive, it wouldn't be something I would support. But I would support working with your primary care doctor, maybe even a therapist, and together trying to figure it out.
Absolutely. Let's take our next House Call question, Daniel.
I'm an 80-year-old man, and I'm healthy. But for 2 days recently, I've had pain in my low abdomen just above my groin. I'm worried it could be a bladder infection, but I have no pain when I urinate. It's just a dull pain, so what are your thoughts?
Gosh, there could be lots of things going on here, and I'd encourage you to go and get this one checked out as well. But sometimes a dull pain in an older man in that area can be related to the prostate, which is, you know, the gland inside, right where your bladder or your urethra, where the urine runs through. And sometimes that can get inflamed or irritated and can be what we call a prostatitis, and you can have sort of a weird dull pain there. Sometimes a urine infection can be present. It could be that. There also, you have to think about diverticulitis if you were having some diarrhea or other abdominal cramping.
Yeah, and then we get even less things. You could have a kidney stone that's kind of come down and gotten a little stuck further down. Sometimes pain in the abdomen, you would worry, you know, could there be some other sort of blockage? But, you know, these
appendix.
Are the sort of things, appendix, you know, these things
hernia.
You're probably going to need to go in and see your doctor about. They need some testing. Could probably figure out. I wouldn't ignore this, particularly if it's been persistent for more than a day.
Great question. Thanks for sharing. Okay, Daniel, what's our last house call question of the day?
My doctor told me to check my blood pressure 4 to 5 times and send him the results, as it was a little high when I was in his office. I was a little embarrassed to ask him, so what time of the day, on a weekend or weekday, or at my house, and by and should I check it at my house and buy a machine or go to a pharmacy? Help.
I can see the problem here. You know, you come in to the doctor and the doctor says, yeah, I just go and check your blood pressure a few times and send it to me. That seems straightforward to me.
Yeah, well, to us, because we recommend it so much and just highlights how confusing doctor instructions can be and how important it is to ask and clarify, you know, what exactly does that mean and when do I come back? When do I send it to you? These questions you're asking are helpful. I think if this was really a first time where your blood pressure was a little high and your doctor was just like, okay, maybe it was if the doctor wants it under 140 is the top number, and maybe it was 142 or 143, maybe your doctor says, okay, well, just check it a few times. If that's the case, then going to the CVS or a pharmacy and getting it checked there, or if you have a friend who has a blood pressure cuff, and just writing it down is the most important thing. What time of, you know, what's the date? What was the blood pressure? I would encourage you not to do it right after you just got in a big fight with your spouse or when you're particularly upset, because it's going to be higher.
Our spouses and I, we never fight, Christy.
Oh, no.
It's perfect.
It's all perfect.
There's
harmony.
No stress in life.
But, and, right. Don't and do it to, right when you're in a moment. I mean, try to get your average state, yeah, unless you're always angry.
Yeah, and not to do it when you're really stressed, but not necessarily also to do it like at 11 o'clock at night when you're just kind of
like halfway asleep.
Yeah, I usually say it's a good time to do it is about the same time each day. And usually your blood pressure is higher during the daytime, so why not find what it truly is when it's at the highest, not when it's at the lowest? You don't want to have it artificially low. And I think the doctor's pointed out an issue, but I think I'd write to the doctor in this case, ask the questions you just asked us, which are great questions, and have your doctor give you a little bit more advice, a little more instructions. There's some great apps that you can record these things. You can transmit it electronically, be part of the medical record, and get this two-way conversation going.
It's true. And we have, I mean, there is growing research showing that that ambulatory blood pressure measure, what you get when you're out in your life compared with what you get when the one time that you come to the doctor, is more accurate and often can pick up subtle changes in your blood pressure that make a difference to your health. So it's good that your doctor wants to follow up on it, can make sure you bring those values or communicate them back to your doctor, and we wish you all the best.
Yeah, you could even do an ambulatory blood pressure monitor.
That
and
is.
And ask your doctor. And don't be embarrassed. Just tell your doctor, you know, you dummy.
I don't know what that means.
You didn't really explain it too well. Well, that'll conclude the house calls for our show today, and we want to thank everyone for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, follow us on Twitter, search for us online at yourhealthradio.org, or get our health app.
And we want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine. We want to thank UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship and our guest today, Dr. Jonathan Alpern. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.